I get brought over to the audience. This is the first.
I think before we started, we were all kind of nervous about it's a bit of fraught territory. So we know it's going to be a contentious debate, but please let's have it because this is how we can move forward.
Thank you everyone for such fantastic papers. It's extremely stimulating. And not with your paper, just then it's such a knockout. It's basically said everything that needs to be said. Thank you so much. But a couple of comments from that. Just on the guerrilla poet trope, with regard to Lionel's work, I wonder whether it would be good to kind of footnote. I'm agreeing with all that other stuff that you're saying about the transcultural and the Creole and stuff.
Could you speak up? Maybe grab a mic.
How far back is
that? That far.
I was just going to suggest that rather than throwing out the guerrilla poet trope that has been attached to Lionel's work, it might be more finesse to footnote that in the... where Lionel was coming from in the 70s and the 80s, that kind of combative guerrilla intention was extremely important. And clearly we're in a different cultural space now, but at that time, that kind of work and to be framing Lionel's work in that mode was really necessary. Maybe it's just something to keep in mind too. Footnote somewhere that was very historically continued for him.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something I wanted to talk about more, but it's very about time. I think there's really strong correlations between his early work and Black Panther poetry, or even like Black Arts Movement poetry, and I'm really fascinated by both and how they intersect. And I hope I can talk about those kind of points of resistance, while also providing a bridge to move beyond that so we can continue to discuss his work in a culturally appropriate way, but also one which engages with this amazingly radical poetic that which is just so fascinating.
Totemic Geographies from Howard Morphy, not from me. I would have loved to
mention it. Okay.
These were fantastic papers, and obviously, given the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States and all the horrors that brought it into existence, the kinds of racialized polarizations and experience of extraordinary painfulness around raciality. Which maybe white people in certain sectors of the U.S. Are experiencing for the first time. I have been wondering if the current U.S. political carnival might be in some way a reflection of or a pushback against or a manifestation of polarization that is happening instead of collaboration, thinking together about the major issues of social injustice, etc. And I wonder if there's any equivalent. I think there is, at least emotionally, in Australian society. But whether this kind of polarization is happening just in a political mainstream, for example?
Oh, just what your remark, Lynn, just reminded me of Ali's comment yesterday that terrorism is on the front page of the newspaper, have a look at what's being discussed in Parliament. Maybe that's sort of a comparison, but yeah.
What I will say is I think the banal expression of occupation in both countries is suburban life. And so what that means is thinking through the systems of violence that support a type of suburban life. Now, if you take climate change as the fundamental starting point for thinking through ethics, I think that what that means is we need to decommodify suburban life, which is not to disregard the violence that happens to individual bodies, specifically bodies that seem to appear to an abstract collective that's grouped as one, even though it's a totally heterogeneous experience. What I will say about suburban life is that America is still a settler society, and the sort of discourse that dominates in America is the black-white tension of relations to the detriment of other types of heterogeneous climate conversations. Now, there might be a way in which black people are complicit with occupation here on a learned land, which is not to necessarily rope them into some position of culpability, but to say there's other nexes of responsibility once you think about the material engagement of face-to-face life. Now, in terms of the polarisation question, I think Australian politics is incredibly polarised, but I also think Australian politics happens outside of parliamentary procedures in a way that matters for people all the time. So, you know, this year on Australia Day, I go to my Invasion Day protest in Melbourne, and that's a good thing to do. But I would also be wary of thinking about the way in which Aboriginal discourse flattens out a whole raft of countries across the nation. So I don't know much about Aboriginal life in Koori country or anything like that. Of course, I go to Sydney as a tourist, but I know a little bit about a little bit of the community in the Western Kuruwa, so we know about mine there, and I know people who participate in the world, and I know Mormon who matter for that country. Whether that's instructive for people all across the world, I'm not going to say. I think what I would say is that people, in order to live a good life, need to have create conditions in which the material circumstances can kind of be taken for granted. Otherwise, it's incredibly anxiety-producing to be a black man walking in Oakland where you can get shot. It's incredibly anxiety-producing to be a young Aboriginal woman in Kununurra after dark. And I think those things are something that need to be thought through as an ethical, practical thing for literary criticism, precisely because close reading allows you to read legislation, allows you to read what police are doing, allows you to engage with language, which is effectively all we have.
Thanks.
Yeah, maybe you can hear me. Thanks very much for the panel. You know, great intersections and maybe solidarity. Well, since we're thinking about the issues of solidarity. I wanted to ask a question for Robbie, and I was interested in this idea of a activist listening. Yeah. And importantly, it seems to me a lot of people think they're doing that.
Sure.
A lot of people, I don't mean, I'm not implicating you, I'm saying politically from all sorts of different spheres, people think that they're doing that. So what interests me at the level of transcription, I want to ask in what ways, I mean, you mentioned it briefly when you talked about homonyms, but that was about it, because I think you're foreshadowing what you might do. I had a question about what forms of transcription do you think that would take place in, say, literary criticism, but then also outside of literary criticism? Because at the moment, if we think about that activist listening, it suffers potentially, I don't mean, again, your model, but it could suffer, being simply mimetic of a given political situation.
Yeah.
So it could be simply prone to whatever politics is going on. And in that sense, it is nothing but the listening to what's going on. So it wouldn't be... So you see what I'm saying? So the adjectival relationship that the activist has to the listening part is up for grabs. And I wanted to know, what types of transcription, what types of writing would you hope to record this activist listening?
Well, I guess it depends partly on what the aim is to be achieved, which is why I refer to climate change in a part and decommodification, because I think we need to overcome some basic materialism. So that's like the vulgar Marxist aspect of it. What I will say is it also depends on which language game one participates in. So I can't necessarily use the phrase language game in Australian Parliament, not only because I don't sit in it, but also because it has no resonance with the common sense language philosophy of Wittgenstein. So it's not like I can say, in paragraph 28 of the Philosophical Investigations in Anscombe's translation, language game means this, which might come with a whole set of references to the conversation we're having. So I think for activists listening, I think it's as flawed as any other tool, but it might just be a useful branding in the paper that gives me cultural capital in this setting. But what I mean is that because of this, there might be something to that, precisely because cultural capital matters, and I think this certainly matters. in basic way, I think, how do you cultivate activist listening? For me, that's talking to people on country, and it's also reading things that I find useful at a particular point in time. Now, I think if you have an appropriate poetic sensibility, you can find almost any poem worthwhile in creating an ethics, right? Now, I think people can do all kinds of amazing critical work regardless of the material that they're dealing with, precisely because they're able to live their frames in an appropriate way. What that I would encourage, though, for other people, because I care about that country, is I would encourage people to reread Tawaruru. I would encourage people to reread John Kinsella because I think he's been an activist. You know, the genesis of this paper was the 1946 Pilbara strike, which is the longest industrial action in Australian history, which took 4 years planning and involved 13 different language groups from around the Pilbara, where 200 lawmen got together in 1942 and sat in the creek and decided they need to walk off stations because it was their country. Now, if you don't believe in terra nullius, you've got to think through what suburban life looks like. You've got to think through what the connection is to mining on country. And I think that's something that I personally find very difficult to do if we're going to live in an activist way. Because I think it's easier to wave a flag than it is for me to actually change my lived material circumstances, which are totally politically complicated. And that involves literary criticism 100%.
I'm a close friend to Lionel, and we were talking about more cultural discussion or observation of his work. And yesterday, or the day before, was the 25th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Blacklist in Custody in Australia. I think one word that's missing here is justice. And Lionel has written his entire life, I think, as a plea for justice. And it's really sad when I'm sitting on the back veranda and watching the sunset again on another day and knowing that he might not see that in his life. And I think, just wanted to say that because in this discussion, that word justice resounds very loud in Australia.
I can just ask a question, not even a question, just something for you about Bonnie, what you talked about John Mateer. I too have a difficulty with Mateer, and after the Australian poetry, the Australian poems, and then he maybe negated that project and then moved towards the Asian poems. And my question is to do with subjectivity in those poems as well, which I found to be disturbing because he actually poses a kind of re-orientalism in that work particularly. So the power and the pleasure of the foreign, in fact, is what the word that he used, the phrase that he uses. So I'm wondering about subjectivity and on the level of language itself as well, because is the subjectivity ever really subtracted, or is subtraction itself enough to reconfigure subjectivity in a way that is, there's a question of appropriation as well. But I wonder if it's just about subjectivity.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. On the latter part of the question, I think that, in a way, I think that that short first poem that I mentioned, Coastal Walk Up from Augusta, is the more successful poem because it implicates its own failure in doing what you just said, in facing the subjectivity of the speaker. As I said, it's that apparent moment of sort of empathy seems to burst like the white water that's on its feet. It may be an illusion. I think that it's a much more complicated poem than in the presence, in lots of ways, for the reason anatomy is in some ways more successful because it burns that complexity, rather than trying to work out what it has in it. The Asian poems, I'm familiar with as a reader, but I haven't read closely, critically, in the same way as the Australian poem, but I'm aware of what you're talking about, this kind of orientalism that's in his work, and it's in a little bit in the last book as well, that's set in sort of Iberian region. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say except to agree with you in making that observation, and I've certainly seen it made in a number of reviews of his work too. So I think there are many readers who pick that up and kind of struggle with that in his work. Yeah.
Sure.
Just following up on that, do you think there's something to do with like his guise of being a nomad or something? Mm. Do you think that obfuscates his complicity or something like that? Maybe.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. I suppose he's...
Because he sets up that... He dropped up as a nomad, you know, writing about South Africa, Andalusia, Asia, Australia, Indigenous Australia.
Mm.
And, like, he's able to just kind of go and be the poet and speak it all or something, I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah,
I think there's levels of privilege which are critically examined in there.
Sorry,
so I think there's levels of privilege which are kind of unexamined within that framework that the Matir sets up.
Just past one, maybe we have time for one more.
I was just following on from that thing about Matir. Isn't it also kind of to do with the fact that poetry, or a certain kind of poetry, is like a very individualizing discourse too? So like these problems come up about the, you know, the probity or the critical acumen of a particular individual. Like, I mean, I also think from what you described, I haven't read that work, but it sounds highly problematic as well. But yeah, and it sounds like he's not able to circumvent that precisely because it is about him or something.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
And I guess this goes back to, you know, Stuart's point about trying to sort of peel away from the tradition of the eye.
Yeah.
The lyric eye, which Matir sort of doesn't peel away from, sort of like leans away from, but constantly comes back to as well. So that peeling away is really fully happening.
I feel like there's something about the problematic of someone who isn't able to continue living where they were born.
Yes. Yeah, and I think it's worth saying that he's not just he's not a chosen visitor of the world. He's someone whose family, you know, left apartheid South Africa. If you think that's what's beginning his kind of, you know, later chosen exile.
Couldn't help feeling what the West meant, because you were writing about John in the West. Robbie's writing about the West. You were in the West. John is the maverick of the West.
Yeah.
Dorothy is from the West.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the West and the Western and what it does outside of the nation. And I feel like I need to really sit with that a bit more.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.